So let's get back into Genesis. Okay, let's pick up with chapter 21. So we see the Eternal visited Sarah as he had said, which he told him ahead of time, she's going to get pregnant, have a baby. For Sarah had conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time that God had ordained for him. How old was he? It's a nice round number. He was 100 years old. So, yeah, and Sarah was 90. Abraham called the son who was born to him, who Sarah bore him, Isaac. Which, it wasn't they just, I'll just out of the blue choose Isaac or looking in baby names. God had told him to call him Isaac, which means laughter. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old as God commanded him. So he perpetuates, he continues the symbol of circumcision on the eighth day, just as God had confirmed. Now, Abraham was, it says here, 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. God fulfilled the promise he had made 25 years ago. But I like to say God didn't do it too late. He didn't do it too early. He did it when he decided it was right. And Sarah said, God has made me to laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. Again, here's where I say Sarah is in on the joke now. We're all laughing about this. It's like, and wouldn't you think if you were 89 years old and you got pregnant, at some point you'd laugh. You might also cry. But I remember my wife was 40 when she still describes, she'd been feeling sick to her stomach and she was late. And I said, you stay there, we're going to have to get one of those tests. And I remember it was a snowy morning in February and she peed on one of those sticks and she looked at it and it turned blue and she said, now? I'm 40 years old. And we were laughing. Matter of fact, because she'd had tests and the doctor said, you're not going to be able to get pregnant. Your hormones aren't right and all this. So she called. She still wasn't certain. She wanted to get a blood test. So we drove across town to her gynecologist in a snowstorm, because she said, I want to know for sure. So, again, Sarah is enjoying this now. God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. She also has said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? I've borne him a son in his old age. We go on there, and now we're going to jump ahead. The child grew and was weaned, and Abraham had a great feast the same day Isaac was weaned. Most kids aren't weaned before they're a year old. This might have been three or so, maybe only a year, but how old does that make Ishmael at this point? Ishmael was 14 years old when Isaac was born. Now we move ahead to him being weaned, and Abraham throws this big feast. So, yeah, Ishmael, by the time we're doing this, and what I want to make the point of, if I can get the words out, in verse 9, Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. That could be translated as laughing, but it seems the intent is I can imagine he's 17 years old, big deal, the guy can eat food, So he's, not all that impressed with Isaac. Sarah sees it, and now she's thinking, hey, get rid of this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman won't be heir with my son, namely Isaac. The matter was displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son, which it doesn't say it, but Abraham loved his son. He's raised him. He'd been childless before that. Abraham must have some kind of decent relationship with Ishmael. He's not just out there part of the clan. I'm getting away from my notes. Abraham's trying to keep the peace. He loved Ishmael. He might have felt kindly towards Hagar, but Sarah's saying get rid of him. That word cast out, the Hebrew, which if I've got it translated correctly, is garash. It can also be translated as divorce. So it seems Sarah's wanting some type of legal distinction made to make sure that Ishmael is not in line for the inheritance or the birthright. Don't have him in here with my legitimate son Isaac. And that grieved Abraham. He didn't want it that way. But God steps in. In verse 12, God said to Abraham, don't let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman, whom whatever Sarah said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Okay, so, and Paul will quote that later, saying, okay, Isaac is the one who's going to be the legal heir. He's going to carry on your name. He's going to have the blessings. But God makes the point, I'm going to take care of Ishmael. In verse 13, yet I will make a nation of the son of the bondwoman because he's your seed. makes me wonder, what came to my mind with this is in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 14, where Paul is explaining that, like, an unconverted mate has a special blessing because of the converted mate. Like, if the husband is in the church and the wife is not, the wife is still holy. And the other way around, he said, else your children were profane, but now they're holy. We usually cite that to explain that the children of people in the church are called by God. But maybe that principle seems to apply here. God's saying, okay, Abraham, you're holy and special to me. Ishmael also is still special because he's your son, and God is going to bless him. And it's, of course, that bears out. We'll see later. It'll describe all of his children and such. So Abraham follows what God says. He rose early in the morning, took bread. Bread probably means provisions, not like, here's one of those baguettes, Hagar, see ya. Probably gives them ample provisions. He gives her a skin of water, probably an animal hide canteen that might have been decent sized, but it's worth keeping in mind, this isn't meant to provide for her for the next 2 or 3 months. It's a size, you know, a canteen would be carried to get from one oasis or one well to another. So the idea is, here's supplies, here's for you to be able to travel. And the reason I'm making this point is, if we'll see that Hagar probably missed a well or an oasis. She took a wrong turn and didn't get to refill the canteen like was planned, and that's why they have this crisis a little bit later. Because it says he sent the boy and Hagar away. When it says boy, you tend to think he's like a 3-year-old toddling behind her, right? But as I said, no, this is, you know, he's 14 when Isaac is born. Isaac is now weaned. He could be as old as 17 years old. So he's not some helpless little baby. But in verse 15, the water in the skin was used up. So they missed the well or the stopping point. And she placed the boy under one of the shrubs, and she went and sat down across from him, a distance of a bow shot. She said, let me not see the death of the boy. Apparently, he's dehydrated, exhausted. She's afraid he's not going to make it. And I've heard, it's funny, I've read this. I know I would have taken offense at this when I was 17, but you know, it said that teenagers, even though they're strong and energetic, they can be more susceptible to dehydration and lack of nourishment. In other words, their energy can run out a little quicker. You know, you're putting in a long day's work, you know, so, well, what I've got is teens can bear thirst and fatigue less well than mature adults. And part of that's mental, and I'm sure part of it's physical. So Hagar's all upset. God is going to step in, though. She went set, didn't want to see the death. In verse 17, God heard the voice of the lad. So not only does he hear Hagar, but the lad, Ishmael. So I suspect he's praying. He's been raised by Abraham. He knows who the true God is. He's probably taught to worship him. So the angel of God calls to Hagar. What's wrong with you, Hagar? Don't fear. God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him in your hand. I will make of him a great nation. That's something, not just I'm going to stop him from dying today, I'm going to make of him a great nation. So God is looking way down the line. Not only are you not going to die, you're going to have kids, and they're going to have kids, and you're going to become the leader of a clan. Yes, yeah, Ishmael is the lad here. Yeah, you don't see his name much. He keeps being called the lad, which, I don't know, when I used to go to camp in Scotland, I heard lad and lassie all the time. And lassie's not a dog over there. It's a young lady. Anyways, yeah, she saw a well of water, filled the skin, gave the lad a drink, and God was with the lad. Now that we pointed it out, we see how often he's called that. He grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. So he becomes Robin Hood out there. Well, maybe not Robin Hood, but Green Arrow instead. No, but he can handle himself out in the wilderness. He becomes very capable. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. His mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Makes sense, maybe from her family. Remember, Hagar was an Egyptian. And there we'll see Ishmael's, you know, if he's the father of the Arabs, they have some racial characteristics that are a bit different, or ethnic characteristics, than the Israelites, because they've got a lot of Egyptian mixed in from early on. But they're still related, not totally distinct. Oh, okay, we go on. We'll leave him there. Later we'll revisit Ishmael. He's not out of the story completely yet. Good, let's move on to chapter 22. No, not 22, but we're going to pick up at verse 22. Now, Abimelech comes back into the story, and Phicol, the commander of his army. So remember, they parted not on the best of terms, but he comes over to Abraham and says, God is with you in all that you do. Maybe he's had people watching and seeing all this. Now therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me. So don't deal falsely. Abraham had dealt falsely with him earlier. So now it's like, let's have an oath that's going to involve truthfulness and that will deal with kindness between, you know, you won't deal falsely with me and my offspring or my posterity. So not just me personally, but all my people. You know, according to the kindness that I've done to you, you know, you will do to me in the land which you've dwelt. Abraham said, yes, I'll swear. So Abraham proposes this covenant. We could say a covenant of peace and involves kindness, truthfulness, good dealing among them. Now, what's going to come up as part of this, it seems to be negotiation about the ownership of this well. Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of this well Abimelech's servants had seized. And he said, well, I don't know this. This is the first time I've heard anything about it. Well, Abraham took sheep and oxen, gave them to Abimelech. The two of them made a covenant. I've speculated, it doesn't say here, but it's possible that they even did the same type of thing that we read back in Genesis 15, where they cut the animals in half and walked between them, cutting a covenant. Possible, don't take that as a definite, but they made some type of ritual to signify a covenant. Abraham brings up something else, and we'll notice people doing things with symbolic meaning to get attention and to signify something. Verse 28, Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech takes the bait, or he knows Abraham's doing this for a reason. So according to the ritual, he speaks out loud. What are the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs? And Abraham says, you'll take these for my hand to be witness that I've dug this well. So we're back to the well. We want to settle this. Therefore, he called the name I always like to say Beersheba. I've heard it pronounced Beersheba. But they made a covenant. Yeah, so Abimelech rose with Phicol as commander, went back to the land of Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree. Some translations call them oak trees, that's the terebinth they call oak. I'm not sure what a tamarisk tree is. Any of you guys know what a tamarisk tree is? It's a tree. We'll take granted for that. We don't have to know exactly the species. And called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. So, again, we're over in this area. You know, closer to the sea. The Philistines are along the coast here towards the south, and that's where Abimelech is. And Beersheba is a little further. Well, it's marked on the map here. This is Beersheba. How do they say it in Israel today? Beersheba. So my customary pronunciation is incorrect according to them. I think I got in Sheba because there's the line over the E that signifies a long vowel sound, but who knows what the translators were thinking. No, I don't have anything more to say about that. I don't know if anyone questions or comments. It's one of those passing things. It's worth noting, though, I mentioned Abimelech is a title. Later, we're going to see Isaac dealing with a later Abimelech, who seems to be a son or grandson of this one. So it's good to keep up family relations and try to remember agreements that your parents or grandparents might have made. But now we're going to move into one of the, I wouldn't say one of the most important chapters of the Bible, because they're all important, but this is a very important and very big story. It starts off in chapter 22, it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. So it came to pass after these things. We don't know exactly how long after. I was speculating, I was thinking of something else. But some people think that this might be close to 15 or 17 years later. There's a thought that at the point where Isaac is told to sacrifice Isaac, Isaac might be about 20 years old. It's hard to say with certainty, but he wasn't just an infant at this point. Especially, I hope not, since Abraham's making him carry the wood. So he's going to be doing some serious work. But God calls Abraham, let's get back to the story. And he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love. Notice the progression. It goes from your son to your only son, and then points out the son that you love. You know, this is going to be a test. Matter of fact, did I overlook? Yeah, it said God tested Abraham. Remember the distinction we made when we were covering James, that you could say a test and temptation, and the Greek would use the same word, but one is trying to get someone to sin. What we see here is not God trying to make Abraham do something evil, but seeing what Abraham is going to do. I'm going to put you to the ultimate test. How will you react in this? Which this goes a long ways to disproving the doctrine of predestination, which we don't believe in predestination. That is, everything is foreordained. God knows everything that will happen and you don't have a choice. Well, God wouldn't need to test Abraham if Abraham didn't have a choice. He's going to test him in an interesting way. We could make, because I'm sure you know he's going to be told to go sacrifice him. Matter of fact, I started to read verse 2. Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love. Go to the land of Moriah and offer him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains. Take this son that you waited 25 years for, now you've raised, go offer him as a sacrifice. What must Abraham have thought? Well, we don't know what thoughts went through his mind. We kind of can deduce what settled in. It's worth noting, though, that God is testing Abraham to see if Abraham is willing to do what God the Father would actually do. God the Father gave up his only son, his firstborn son, whom he loved, as a sacrifice for us. And nobody stopped short of Christ's life coming to an end. But Abraham, God just testing to see if Abraham's willing. But do you see the parallel there? We'll see some others as we go along. Amazingly, no matter what he may have thought or not thought, Abraham doesn't hesitate. Verse 3, Abraham rose early in the morning. He didn't even hit the snooze on his alarm. Saddled the donkey, took two young men with him and Isaac his son, split the wood for the burnt offering. So he makes all the plans and goes to the place where God told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. So the journey took 3 days. There's another parallel. Because Hebrews 11:19, we mentioned earlier, says Abraham considered Isaac dead. In Abraham's mind, it was a certainty. So we can say in Abraham's mind, Isaac was dead 3 days and three nights. Well, it doesn't say the three nights here, but we might sort of see the parallel. Jesus Christ was dead and in the tomb 3 days and three nights. And we know Abraham's faith was such, as we discussed earlier, that he never thought he was going to lose Isaac. And there in Hebrews 11, it says that he believed God would resurrect him. And we just have to, you know, take the Bible's word for it, that you know, Abraham's convinced, okay, I'm going to obey God, and God is going to bring him back to life because God is going to fulfill the promises he made. So let's continue. Well, matter of fact, let's see something that supports that in verse 5. Abraham said to the young men, he had two men with him, stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and I'll come back to you after I've killed him. No, he says, we will come back to you. Again, Abraham, now he could have been, we could say, well, he was just fooling them, because if he said, I'm going to go kill him, they might have tried to stop him. But if we put this together with what it says in Hebrews, that he believed God would bring him back to life, so he believes maybe he's going to do it right away. So we will come back. Supports the idea that Abraham was confident of that. So he took the wood and the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac's son, took fire in his hand and a knife, the two of them together. That reminds me of something we pointed out when I used to teach wilderness skills at camp. He probably wasn't carrying fire in his hand, but he might have had some embers that he could get a fire going with, or I would say flint and steel, but steel was in short supply. But you know, you can transport things to get a fire going with, and they go up there. That's a little side issue. Verse 7, Isaac spoke to his father and said, my father, here I am. Dad, look, there's fire, wood. Where's the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, my son, God will provide for himself a lamb for a burnt offering, and the two went together. So at this point, during those 3 days, Abraham hadn't told Isaac what's about to happen. We don't know why, but we're going to move on to where it says they came to the place, Abraham built the altar, placed the wood, and he bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar. At some point, it seems that Abraham probably let Isaac know what was going on. Why would I say that? Any thoughts?
He didn't resist.
What's
it? Isaac didn't. It didn't make it sound like Isaac resisted.
Okay, it doesn't sound like he resisted. And well, I could ask a question. Do you think he could have resisted? Okay, so I'm making the point, Isaac might be anywhere from 17 to 20 years old. Therefore, Abraham's like 120 years old. Is a 120-year-old man going to tie up a 20-year-old if the 20-year-old doesn't want to be tied up? Now, Abraham might have been quite a physical specimen, but most people say no. Somehow, Isaac probably did join in and was willing. So it doesn't tell us when Abraham told Isaac what was going on, but I agree. I think it seems he was willing to do this. And we see more parallels. He carried the wood for a sacrifice, similar to the way Jesus Christ bore his cross. And he willingly gave himself up. If Isaac willingly gave himself up, there's a parallel to Jesus Christ. And we move on from there. I'm looking for there. In verse 10, Abraham stretched out his hand, took the knife to slay his son. So everything we've seen from the time God first spoke to Abraham, Abraham's not hesitating, and even when it comes down to it, and the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham, here I am. I wonder if the knife's still there. It's like, okay, what? He said, don't lay a hand on the lad. Don't do anything to him. Now I know. Funny, God must have had some idea before, but now he knows for certain. Now I know that you fear God, since you've not withheld your son from me, your only son. And Abraham lifted his eyes, and there was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. God did provide a sacrifice other than Isaac. He went and took it and offered it as the ram for a burnt offering. Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." As it said in that day, "The mount of the Lord, it will be provided." I've got that as Yahweh Jireh, if I have it proper. Which I've seen some accounts say it could be interpreted as the Yahweh sees, or more completely, he sees your need and provides. So God is aware of what's needed. So like the Eternal One will provide. That's the meaning there. And it's called the Mount of Yahweh Jireh. And it's speculated and widely believed that this was where? The Temple Mount, where the temple would later be built. Okay, so that's tradition, and in Josephus's account, he says very plainly that that's where this happened, and it's generally believed to be that. Some speculate that it actually wasn't the Temple Mount, but was actually the place that would later be known as Golgotha, or Calvary, where Christ was sacrificed. I suspect it probably is one or the other, because God does things that way, it seems, but I don't know for certain. The Temple Mount makes sense. That's where the sacrifices would be offered. Of course, that's where Ornan the Jebusite's threshing floor was, where God ceased the plague, and had David go and offer a special sacrifice. But at any rate, we know that. Let's move on. In verse 15, then the angel of the Eternal called to Abraham a second time and said, "By myself I have sworn, says the Eternal, because you've done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing, I'll bless you, and multiplying, I'll multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, as the sand which is on the seashore. Your descendants will possess the gates of their enemies." So, if it wasn't earlier, remember I speculated that when Abraham cut the animals in half and the torch went through without Abraham, that God was obligating himself. If that wasn't the case there, we say here God made the promises unconditional, and he swore by himself. Hebrews 6, verse 13 says that God did that because there was nothing greater he could swear by. Generally, you swear by something greater or more enduring than yourself, although Christ told us not to swear at all, but God swore by himself that he would do this. And he doesn't say, "I'll do this if you continue to obey." He just says, "It's going to happen. Have all these children, you're going to grow to a great nation, and possess the gates of your enemies." We've put an interpretation on that over the long term that some people think is a stretch, but I don't think so when we think of who the descendants of Abraham became. By gates of the enemies, it doesn't mean like if I don't like my next door neighbor, I can go take his gate. We see that as applying to strategic places on the globe, specifically for naval transport. We use the term sea gates. And we've seen the English-speaking people in possession or control of the most significant ones on earth, like the Strait of Gibraltar, where you come in and out of the Mediterranean Sea, and on the other end, the Suez Canal. They had to build that one. But we can see others, Cape Hope, you know, the southern tip of Africa, controlled by the nation of Britain. The Falkland Islands controls access to Cape Horn, the southern tip of South America. You have certain islands like Hawaii, Wake, the Philippine Islands, controlled by the United States. Jamaica, Puerto Rico, and Florida controlling access to the Gulf. We go on talk about the Aleutian Islands, Australia, New Zealand. So if this can be applied to sea gates, it's obvious to see, you know, the English-speaking peoples have had them in their possessions. I've seen some people talk about certain mountain passes that were under British control too. But I'm getting a field there, but it's worth making that note when we look for the fulfillment of these promises. Okay, because we're going to sort of switch gears a little bit. In verse 19, Abraham returned, went back. And I have one question that I don't find the answer to in the Bible, and I still wonder, is when did Sarah find out what was going on in all this? Doesn't tell us. You know, I suspect that Abraham didn't tell her before he left, because he would have had a hard time leaving and taking Isaac. And imagine if you come back and say, well, Sarah, let me tell you what happened. She probably hit him over the head with a rolling pin then or something. Or maybe not. I mean, she knew God as well. But in verse 20, we have a little interlude. The last four verses here seem to be there just to show that God was preparing an opportunity for Isaac to have a wife that God would choose, and that it'd be in a different branch of the family. Because it says, it came to pass after these things, it was told Abraham, Milcah has borne children to your brother Nahor. So Abraham's brother Nahor had children, and they would have children. And it lists a lot of hard-to-pronounce names there, which I'm not going to bother trying to pronounce. Although, there's something interesting in verse 21. There's somebody named Buzz. And I'm not saying that just because it's funny to say, hey, your name's Buzz. But some people have speculated that this might be the ancestor of Elihu or Elihu, depending on how you pronounce it, the Buzzite, who's mentioned in Job chapter 32. The Elihu who goes on to explain what Job and his friends should have been knowing. If this Buzz is an ancestor of that Elihu, it would give us some idea of when the story of Job happens. Because there is a lot of speculation. When did Job happen? I've seen some think it happened before Noah's flood. Some a little bit later. Some think it happened during the time of the patriarchs, or perhaps during the time that the Israelites were slaves in Egypt. And one of the reasons for this, and probably Dr. Urweiler will mention, is through all the story of Job, there's a lot of talk about God and his great works, but there's no mention of the nation of Israel, which seems kind of curious because Israel is so prominent in the Bible. But it would make sense if Israel hasn't become a nation yet and Job is separate. And that's one of the things that makes me think. Remember I said we're focusing on Abraham and his descendants, this one nation, but God's not unaware of everything else going on the planet. And maybe he had relationships with other people. So while we're reading about Abraham and then Isaac and all this, there's other stuff going on that God is very well aware of. He's not ignorant. He just didn't preserve the stories of them for us. Anyways, this will become important. Well, actually, not only soon, but really soon, a couple chapters later when it's time for Isaac to get married. But we've got something else that happens first. And it's something sad. In verse 23, Sarah lived 127 years, and these were the years of the life of Sarah. So Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, and the land of Canaan. Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Something of note, Sarah, we'll see, is actually the only woman in the Bible whose age, death, and burial are recorded. Which, you know, and not that many men do we have all that, but Sarah's the only one. In Galatians 4, Paul will use Sarah as a type of the church, contrasting Sarah and Hagar. Galatians 4, verses 22 to 31, you know, spells that out. Abraham is known as what? Father of the faithful. Okay. I've heard some say that maybe it would be appropriate to call Sarah the mother of the faithful. Actually, when I say some specifically, I think Vernon Hargrove is the first person I heard mention that. And I've heard him give sermons drawing lessons from the life of Sarah. And I always liked that. Sarah had some weaknesses, but so did Abraham, but she had lived a life worth noting. And we see Abraham mourned and wept. So he had a formal mourning, but he wept, genuine grief. And naturally, they'd been married a long time. Let's remember, Sarah, we believe, was 91 when Isaac was born and lived to age 127. So that's long enough. Even though she bore him when she was very old, she raised him to maturity. Isaac was probably 36 or 37 years old when he lost his mother. And I'm sure he still thought it was too soon, but still, it wasn't that he was just an infant and never knew her. Now, we'll go on. This chapter will show, actually, it's interesting for not only showing that Sarah was properly buried, we'll see the family obtaining a burial place, but it also might indicate some of the culture of the time and certain bits of tact. Because it says in verse 3, Abraham stood up from before his dead, spoke to the sons of Heth. The sons of Heth means the Hittites. The Hittite peoples were based largely up in this area around Greece, but apparently they colonized and they were down here. So some of the sons of Heth were here. And we see Hittites come up in the Bible at times. For centuries, people believed that the Hittites were just a myth, that they didn't exist. And then archaeologists found records showing that they were a real people by that name. And so, you know, as I said, later archaeological discoveries supported what the Bible had said all along. Abraham stands up, and it seems that now we're describing a formal meeting. He's there with several people. He spoke with them, saying, "If it's your wish that I bury my dead out of my sight, hear me. Meet with Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me." Oh, I jumped ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah, I went from verse 3 down to 8. Let me go to verse 4, because Abraham says, "I am a foreigner and a visitor among you." He's describing himself with words that could be translated to say, "I'm a resident alien." It's like, "I'm here with a green card. I need your help." That's pretty humble term for someone that they will describe as a mighty prince. He says, "I'm just a stranger and a foreigner," and they'll call him a mighty prince among them. And he says, "Give me a property for a burial place that I may bury my dead." So he wants to buy some property. He doesn't own any property anywhere. Sons of Heth answered and said, "Yes, you're a mighty prince. Bury your dead in the choicest of our burial places. None will withhold a place from you." So Abraham stood up, mourned. He said, "If it's your wish that I bury my dead, speak with me to Ephron, the son of Zohar." Abraham might have heard of Ephron or might have known him personally. Because here in verse 10, it says Ephron dwelt among the sons of Heth, but the Hebrew there could be translated, he was sitting among the sons of Heth. So this might have been a transaction where he's there and to speak to Ephron, whether Abraham knows who he is and he's just speaking in formal language, or he doesn't know who he is and it turns out there he is. And we begin some formalistic language, but it might also represent a type of negotiation. Because he says, "Speak with him that he will give me the cave of Machpelah, which he has, which is in the end of a field. Let him give it to me at the full price as a property." So Abraham wants to buy the cave. So Ephron's there. He answered and said, verse 11, "No, Lord, hear me. I give you the field and the cave that's in it. I present it in the presence of my people." So Abraham wanted to buy the cave, and Ephron is offering the field. Some have said it might be saying, "Look, okay, I'm open to negotiation, but if you want the cave, you have to buy the whole field too." But politeness requires him to offer it as a gift, which he knows Abraham will decline. This is somewhat speculation. It could be exactly what it says, but people who study the culture say it might be sort of this, "Okay, you know, I'll give it to you." But he would be really insulted if Abraham says, "Great, give it to me." So Abraham has to say, "No, I'm going to pay money for it," which he does. Abraham bowed himself, and he spoke to Ephron, saying, "If you'll give it to me, please, I'll give you money." You know, Ephron said, "Oh, listen to me. It's worth 400 shekels, but what's that between you and me?" If this is negotiation, 400 shekels is probably a lot more than it's worth. And he's expecting Abraham to come back and say, "I'll give you 200. You know, that would be the way it goes, but Abraham is generally caught up in mourning, so he's fine. 400, I'm not even going to argue about it. So he does. Abraham listened to Ephron. He weighed out the silver, which he named for the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of currency of the merchants. So the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, before the cave, and all of the trees that were in the field and the surrounding borders were deeded to Abraham as a possession. I wasn't going to read all that, but it's worth noting the archaeological evidence they found of the culture of the Hittites shows that they did have fairly detailed land deeds. And some of those deeds specified how many trees were on a piece of property and things like this. So what I'm getting at is that the account here is backed up by what archaeologists have found as historical records. So it's very realistic, and there's no reason for us to think it's not real. Verse 18, Abraham, it was deeded to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that's in it were deeded to Abraham. So it's all his. Interesting, I've got a reference in my notes to Hebrews 11, verse 39. We're describing Abraham and also the others, mentions that he didn't receive the promise. What did God promise? I'm going to give you all this land. But during his lifetime, Abraham didn't receive it. And it mentions later in Hebrews, he's looking for a better country, a spiritual. So even though he's looking forward to his descendants owning all of this, all he ever owned was this one small field with a cave in it. But his faith was on something much bigger. Eventually, who's going to be buried in this cave? Well, Sarah's there now. Later, Abraham will be buried there. Isaac and Rebekah will both be there. And Leah and Jacob. And there's some speculation about Joseph and the other tribal patriarchs. That's speculation, but the other six we know are there. Yeah.
Do you know where this cave is now?
I don't know. I would be surprised if there isn't some place that they say is it, but I don't know if they know for sure. Danielle, do you know? Okay. And it may be. I think it'll be interesting when the first resurrection comes. It'd be a cool place to be. You know, all those people coming up, and I've heard people say, "What a family reunion." Okay, so there we have that. And again, the story will bring us back to that particular cave again at these significant moments when people are being buried. But happily, we get to go from there to a much happier story. Okay, it's sad. Sarah died. Now Abraham, it says he's old, he's well advanced in age, even though he's going to live considerably longer than he thought he probably would. We believe what's going to happen in chapter 24 will be anywhere from 2 to 4 years after Sarah's death. Isaac was probably about 36 or 37 then. He'll be 40 when he gets married. Okay. And this chapter might have filled most of a year because it's going to include them, people traveling from here all the way up, to northern Mesopotamia and back. And that's not something you hop in your Volvo and go over in a day. Maybe they can do that today, but back then it was a journey of weeks or months. Okay, so anyways, Abraham's old, well advanced in age. The Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So he calls his oldest servant of his house who ruled over everything he had. I mentioned earlier, this might be the servant that Abraham mentioned earlier as his heir, Eleazar. Although when Abraham was talking about Eleazar was 50 years earlier, so that Eleazar might be dead and this is someone else. If it's someone else, we never find out what his name is. That's one of the reasons people plug Eleazar's name in there, but it's worth noting it'd be easy to make an argument that it might not have been him. At any rate, he calls him in and says, "Put your hand under my thigh, and I'll make you swear by the Lord God of heaven that you won't take a wife for my son or the daughters of Canaanites where I dwell." Hand under my thigh, there's discussion over what exactly it means. We know it was a position of vulnerability. Some say it meant take hold of my genitals, which is extreme vulnerability, but it's like you got to have a lot of trust, whatever it was, So there's something like that. The phrase will appear once or twice in the Bible, and I'll leave it just at open speculation exactly what it might have been. But he's going to send this servant to get a wife for Isaac. Abraham didn't go himself. He might have just thought he was too old, or he might have thought, well, God told me to leave my countrymen and, you know, didn't want me to go back even when there was a famine in the land, so he's sending someone else. And he wants Isaac to marry one of his own people. You know, custom preferred marriage within a person's tribe, but it seems Abraham's biggest concern is I want him to marry someone who will worship the same God, the one true God, and not worship idols. And of course, we've got to stay here in the promised land. So, swear by the Lord God of heaven and earth that you won't take a wife. I read that in verse 3. But go to my country and to my family and take a wife for my son Isaac. Remember, a couple chapters ago, we saw that Abraham's brother had children and they had children. The servant has a good question. Well, what if a woman won't come back with me? Should I take Isaac back there? No, by no means. Abraham says, if you can't get a woman to come back here, you're released from the oath, but don't take Isaac back there. Very specific about that. So obeying the command to stay in the promised land was preeminent. In verse 7, Abraham's going to state God's promise and that he believes in it. The Lord God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and the land of my family, who spoke to me, swore to me, saying, to your descendants I'll give this land. He'll send his angel. So he made this promise. If the woman won't come back, you're released from the oath, but don't send my son there. Servant put his hand under his thigh and swore to him. I'm going to summarize some here because it's a long chapter, but the story isn't quite as long. But all of Abraham's wealth is at this servant's disposal. It says he's going to take 10 camels, and he's going to have camel jockeys, and I don't mean that as a pejorative term, somebody to lead the camel and take care of him and load up all this wealth and supplies for several months' journey. They're bringing a lot of food with them. Okay, and they take the journey, and they don't describe how long the journey takes, but it says he went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. So maybe this is Haran or maybe a different city now in the same area, but he made his camels kneel down outside the city at a well of water, and the well would be a natural gathering place. Of course, they probably want to get some water, but if you're looking for people, that's also a place to look. And he's going to pray a prayer and ask for a miracle. Verse 12, he said, O Lord God of my master Abraham. It's worthy of note, this servant has been taught about God. He's praying him as the God of Abraham, but it seems clear that it's also his God. He believes in this God. Maybe he was born in Abraham's house and has worshipped the true God all his life. I think I've made a note somewhere in my notes that we don't see many examples in the Old Testament of prayer. You do see some, but not all the time. But here's a pretty specific one, and he asks for a miracle. He says, let this woman come, and I'm gonna see women, I'm gonna ask them to give me a drink of water, which is no big deal. They're going there to get water. Here, let me have a sip. But the one who offers to draw water for my camels, let her be the one. Do you know how much water 10 camels can drink? Probably a lot. And water weighs, what, about 8.5 pounds per gallon. It's heavy stuff. Matter of fact, whenever I talk about this, I remember when I worked in Big Sandy, I worked for the water plant on the campus there. We purified our own water and had our own water and sewage system. And we also had a farm. And we were always going out and fixing the water lines to the water troughs for the cows. And I remember talking to my boss once, like, man, how are these things always empty? He says, have you ever seen a cow drink? They go up there and they just suck up gallons of water, and that's where the milk comes from. But camels can be like that. They can go a long time without drinking, but when they do, so the point I'm making is for a woman to just, for this complete stranger, say, yeah, I'll draw enough water for 10 camels, it'd be, I'm trying to think what would be comparable today. It's like, I don't know, if I go up, you're having snacks, I say, can I have a bite of your cookie? I say, well, I'll go fix you a Thanksgiving dinner for you and your whole family, you know? A lot bigger deal. And so he's amazed when the first woman he asks, in verse 15, before he's even finished, Rebecca, who he doesn't know it, but is basically Isaac's cousin or second cousin, comes out, she's got a pitcher, and she's drop-dead gorgeous, apparently. She's out of water, he runs up and says, let me have a drink. Drink, and I'll water your camels also. Verse 20, she emptied the pitcher in the trough, went to draw water. Verse 21, the man wondering at her remained silent. I imagine his jaw drops. Like, wow, God answered my prayer just like that. He's amazed. Which is not an uncommon reaction when God works a miracle for you. You know, it's a pretty cool thing. So when the camels had finished drinking, he's convinced that this is the one. He's got the miracle he asked for, so he breaks out the gold and silver jewels, puts a nose ring on her and two bracelets. The nose ring weighs half a shekel, which is good. I guess it's in your nose. You don't want to be too heavy. Bracelets weighing 10 shekels of gold, and says, "Whose daughter are you? Tell me, is there house room in your father's house?" Well, she says, "I'm the daughter of Bethuel, Milcah's son, whom she bore." And we've got place room for you. You can stay. I'm summarizing. But in verse 27, he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth. As for me being out of the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren." I love that phrase. I'm traveling to a far country, and God led me to the house of my master's brethren, his own family. I use that in a song. I think when I first was sent to Portsmouth to pastor, I gave a sermon citing that, because I said, I'm traveling to a new place, but God led me to the house of my master's brethren, my master being Jesus Christ and all us being his brethren. So when we travel, we can have that experience. I'm looking. Okay, yeah. We'll start with verse 29 next time.